Well, there were limits to what we could do, of course, in the way of discipline, according to King's Rules and Regulations, K-O-R, King's Orders and Regulations. But I made our own rules, and so that we say, well, we give you 5 days confined to barracks, but we didn't have any barracks. Well, they weren't in barracks, they were students. But we say, now you give us your timetable. And all the spare time they had, from 9 o'clock in the morning till 6 at night, we make them sit in this room and study. And if they refuse to do it, well, then we strike them off strength. All we had to do was put it through an order, strike them off strength. Judge Manson checked these orders, and if he saw if I was struck off strength, right, he'd get a call, you see. So they knew they had to do it.
Well, the military service wasn't, there wasn't conscription until 1944. So how could they call him up if he didn't volunteer?
I know they did call them up anyway. The conscription didn't start until 1944?
Well, it wasn't used, as far as I know. Mind you, Mackenzie King, I think 1941, had a plebiscite to release the government from its pledge not to use conscription, so the government could, if it wanted to. I'm not sure how this would have fitted in. I understand he didn't really have to use it until 1944.
Well, these, I don't know, right from 1940, it seems to me that these students were given exemption by attending university. It was compulsory to take COTC training in the university.
This was a decision by the board and the Senate, right?
There was a decision by the university presidents meeting in Harthouse, I believe, at the University of Toronto. I was down for the meeting, and they passed a regulation that, what do they call it, the National Conference of Canadian Universities or something, that military training would be compulsory in the universities.
How could they enforce that? Under what?
Well, they couldn't enforce it other than they agreed that it would be, and each president came back, went back to his institution and said, the other universities are doing it and we're going to make it compulsory here.
And if a student objected?
Well, if a student objected, he couldn't stay in the university, I think.
He was expelled from attending university.
But it seems to me, you say conscription came in when? In 19...
Well, I understand that
you weren't already in 1944. That was near the end of the war.
Yeah,
well, I don't know. There was a... But it certainly was before 1944 that Judge Manson had the deferment of people from call-out. I don't know, it has to be a point worth looking at. But in any case, this is the point about Dr. Kling. I don't think he was in favor of this regulation. But if the universities agreed to it, and he was there at the meeting, then he was going to see that UBC played its part in accordance with what had been agreed upon. I say he personally wasn't in favor of it, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, he might, of course, I think he appreciated that this is a very dangerous situation with Hitler, and that Canada needed to do everything possible to help defeat this evil force in the world. I think he would feel that.
Yeah.
But he would dislike having to become involved in forcing people to take military training. I think that would. But when he's once committed, Dr. Kling, there was no wavering. He never. He was an unusual person that way.
Did you? Initiate any changes when you became commanding officer?
I don't think so.
Lutzen?
I don't think so. Let's say
1937-1938, the Army Council, an Army Council report listed UBC as one of the universities where A and B graduates certificates were eligible for commissions in the British Army. Do you recall this statement, I wonder if it signifies that you have been fully recognized.
Yes, I guess I faintly recall it, but that was, yes, that's correct.
Also, in that year 37-38, the training period was extended. Like, I think about, you must have added about a month during the university term onto the actual training period. And I wonder why that came about that time.
Well, I think that because of the international situation, we felt that we were really training people for war. And before that, it was not so definite that they'd be using this training immediately.
Were there any other repercussions, like, say, during the Spanish Civil War and the rearmament of Germany? How did you receive instructions from the command regarding this, from the national defense?
I don't think we had. We would get intelligence reports. I didn't have too much time to read these because I was still active in my university work. But I think the thing that was most decisive was the failure of the United Nations to curb Mussolini and his venture into Ethiopia. And it became obvious that the League of Nations was not going to be able to function as it, everybody had hoped. So therefore, there was an axis between Mussolini and Hitler, and it seemed fairly obvious that we were going to have another world war.
Did public opinion change in your favor a lot more then in the late 30s?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, the opposition to the CODC died out pretty well, I would say. There wasn't any opposition by the time I took over as Speaker. I think Colonel Logan was the best man to command the CODC when the opposition was at its peak, because he wasn't a military man in many senses. He was such a mild-mannered fellow, and he was so popular with everybody, and he was so involved in so many good works that they couldn't possibly attack him, you see, personally. And this was just one of his many activities at UBC.
Mm-hmm. If most of the military historians say that we're predicting at the time that the warfare, this is regarding the army, would be much more mechanized and much more technical. Did your training program modify itself over the years to take that into account?
Oh, to some extent. Slowly, I would say, but not very much. The manuals didn't change very much. It takes a long while, it did, to change one of the military training manuals. I think most of them were written after the South African War.
Mm-hmm. Did the status of the Corps change when war broke out? Were you still just a training corps, or were you under any military obligation?
No.
No military obligation.
But we took in graduates who were not students for training in the evening and so forth. Well, they would join the Corps. They went to camp with us and so forth. We had special parades for them in the evening to help them qualify for commissions.
I see.
Well, they weren't always graduates, too. There were one or two that we took on, and we said that they had to be university graduates, but there were one or two that we accepted we weren't even university graduates. Because they couldn't get the qualifications downtown. They didn't have the staff, they didn't have the manuals, they didn't seem to know how to go about training people for the officer qualifications.
This is an interesting turn of events. This is in September 1939. The Canadian General Staff stated that enlistees into COTC should be prepared to serve in the forces very soon. And then, a few days later, this is being reported in UBC, they reversed this decision, saying, no, there'll be no obligation at all. Do you recall any of that? Or how?
No, I don't recall it, but I would say that the first was a mistake to suggest that they enlisted in the COTC, that they were then obligated to join the service. This was never the intention of the COTC.
The Department of National Defense adopted a policy of encouraging students to stay in university and graduate before they enlisted in the active services. Do you know how that decision came about or why?
Well, because I think that they felt that this was a war in which there would be far more greater need for people with technical training, and that science didn't play much of a role in World War I, but it was very obvious in World War II that not only in the military, but in all the supporting services, they would need university graduates in great numbers.
Did the universities, or did UBC support this point of view?
Yes.
Did you yourself agree with it?
Did which?
Did you agree with it yourself?
First? Yes, yes.
How about graduates in the arts, did you think?
Well,
they should apply to them.
They were, it applied to them too, because, well, they were required in intelligence service, interpreters, and there's always a demand for them too, I think.
When there is compulsory military training, all the students who you recruited, were they all sort of aiming for commissions for officer training, or was there just more of sort of basic soldier training?
Well, I think some of them probably didn't want to be officers, and they took it as basic training. One could take basic training without taking the certificate for the officers. If you wanted to become an officer and qualify, you had to take extra lectures. There were certain basic trainings you had to take, mainly attend parades and so forth, and go to camp. But you didn't have to take the lectures. There were quite a number of lectures associated with the officer training that a great number of students didn't take at all. Most of them thought the war would be over before they out of the university anyway, I think. So they just took the minimum. And the minimum really involved mainly parades.
So when these students graduated, they would have had some basic military experience, and then presumably they would enlist in the ranks.
Yes, but some of them could go into the National Research Council and various other organizations. Everybody wasn't required to go into the military when they graduated.
So
there was deferment for people working at the National Research Council. You could graduate at UBC, and then you could go and work in the National Research Council and still get deferment. And there were other organizations. Polymer, I suppose, Polymer is in operation then. One would get exemption to work for an essential war industry. I'm sure that there are some went and worked for the Boeing plant down on Sea Island down here. They would get deferment. They wouldn't get exemption, they'd get a deferment, so that if the situation changed and they did need more people, they could call them up, but they were deferred, mostly indefinitely.
How did the campus change during the war? Vast recruitment, and how did you cope with the sudden influx?
Well, the thing that bothered me most, some of the professors enlisted in the ranks in the COTC, quite a few of them took training. And the thing that bothered me most, I used to be embarrassed about it, because we wore our uniforms on the campus some days then, if it was a parade day. And one of these professors come along and they salute me, you know. There was no way to get around it, you know. But I didn't think it was proper for a senior professor maybe to salute me on the campus, but it didn't happen very often, fortunately.
How about space for a drill and accommodation, office space, equipment? It must have been a real problem for us to handle all this.
Yeah, well, we started building the armory pretty shortly after the war, this was quite a problem. An interesting story there too, because we couldn't, timber was under control, you see, and we couldn't get the timber, the lumber to build the armory. And I went to Ottawa, timber controller down there. I told him I was going to sit in his office until he agreed to it, because I said, don't tell me, I have to go back and tell these students. Well, the university says military training is compulsory. And I said, it rains all the time in the winter out there, and we have forestry is the main industry, and you tell me we can't have a few carloads of lumber to build a shelter for these students when they're willing, they waive their pay. And so on, I just laid it on the line and eventually got it. Well, then later we wanted to put an addition on the armory. So I went down and tried the same thing again. And he said, you know, Shrum, the mistake I made was ever letting you have the first, agreeing the first time. He said, I guess I'll have to let you do it this second time now. So we had the armory. And we were one of the few COTCs in Canada then that had good accommodation. We had the best in Canada. Best, by all odds, the best facilities. We had a very fine officer's mess, orderly room, all the, everything we needed.
The war broke out. You stated that training, quote, will be more theoretical and technical than formerly. Why did you make that statement, and how did you?
Well, I guess we had to put in more time, and since we didn't have the military equipment to do the more practical things, so we'd better do what we would be equipped to do. And so we would have, we did a lot of work on map reading and this sort of thing, where we could get professors who were well qualified in these fields to help, you see. I think that was the main reason, just a necessity. We didn't have the military people, and we had no military equipment, so we tried to, and we had to put in, wanted to put in more time. People wanted to prepare for the future, and this was the best way to do it, I guess.
There was a serious problem of lack of instructors, wasn't there?
Oh, yes.
Because they're in the active services.
That's right. They were needed to train the troops that were being enlisted.
In what ways did you overcome this, or partly overcome this problem?
Well, as I say, we, for the military parades, we used these junior students if they'd had cadet training in the schools. Some of them were very good, and we used those. And we borrowed some. Our parades were on Saturday afternoons, most of them, and some of the military units didn't parade on Saturday afternoon, and we'd make arrangements to get some of the instructors come out from town to help us.
Was the faculty on campus cooperative and helpful during the war?
With one or two exceptions, yes. Extreme.
Volunteer time for lectures? They would volunteer their time for lectures?
Yes, and they would arrange for students to get into sections where they could take the training, you know. So, yes, I would say that the faculty was very cooperative.
How about the student body?
Well, the fact that they voted in the auditorium to waive their pay after the Navy came in, the Navy, and I had this meeting in the auditorium and put it up to them, and I didn't think they would, but they did vote to waive their pay, so I think that's a pretty fair indication that they were trying to be cooperative and helpful. Now, I don't say what would have happened if they had voted not to waive their pay. I didn't issue any threats or anything. If I had, they wouldn't have voted. But I appealed to them on the basis that what the money was being used for. And some of them said, well, what will happen? The war's over. What are we going to do with all this money? Well, I said, I'll guarantee that it'll stay at the university and be used. And it's still at the university, the money that was, we had more than we could use.
How about the student war chest and the Red Cross? Was it quite successful?
I don't know very much about it.
October 1940, this is the controversy. there's an editorial in the UBC which argued that the timetables of the COTC be altered to accommodate applied science courses, or either that or they should be given credit for their courses. And a meeting was held with the science students, and you attended the meeting and you excluded the press.
In which?
You excluded the press from the meeting, the UBC reporters. And after the meeting, the science students agreed that there was no conflict. I just wondered what you said at this meeting.
I can't remember. But I would say that, as I said earlier, that Dean Vinnison wasn't wholeheartedly supporting. He felt, maybe quite honestly, that the engineering students would be better. They were going to be used as engineers in the war anyway, and that they didn't need this parades and military training and so forth. And he wasn't very cooperative in that respect, but I can't remember the meeting.
It sounds like he must have been quite angry, though, if you made sure that the UBC didn't want any part of them at the meeting. They had, you said they'd made a mistake in their editorial, too, so I just wondered what,
I can't remember.
Was the university sensitive to criticism, like from the public, that students were being privileged because of being deferred?
I mean, there was a little bit of this, but I don't think it was very serious. There was a little bit of that, but I don't. On the whole, I think that most people agree that the sort of war we were fighting was going to be a long war, and that you need university-trained people to prosecute it. There was certainly no university students didn't go downtown. I don't think they were subject to any snide remarks or anything because they were still in the university.
Were there any defense measures on the campus at the time?
Only in connection with that, down where the Fort Camp was. There was nothing. I don't think there was any military restrictions on the campus. There were, in the chemistry department, they had some rooms that were double locked and so on, where they claimed they were doing more research. And there was some restriction on this, but it didn't amount to very much.
How about blackouts?
We had blackouts in University Hill here. And that was very early in the war. I had this place, I had this all blacked out, and then they had civil defense volunteers going around at night, see if they could see a little bit of light through the window. Harry Warren was very active in this. He could tell you about that. Mm-hmm. He was very active. It used to be a bit of a joke. You don't get the lights out, like Harry Warren will be at your door, because he took this very seriously. No military experience or interest, but then he threw himself wholeheartedly in civil defense.
In the term beginning 1942, you announced a change in the training, and you said, now most of the time will be spent on practical training. Do you know why this change came about? Is it because of demands for men?
I don't know. It may be that...
Were supplied with equipment?
It may be that the units, I guess the units that were taking our people said they weren't capable of handling men, these university students, They needed more practical experience because they were going directly into sort of reinforcements and so into the units that were already established. And I expect that there was this suggestion that we were training them theoretically because they were going to take part in various aspects of the war. But if we were going to feed more officers into active service units, they had to have more practical training. I think that was it, to handle men and so on.
Also in 1942, that was when the University Naval Training Division started and the University Air Training Plan.
Mm-hmm.
How did you fit that into your directing military affairs on campus? How did you coordinate those? Or was there any
well, this was a little difficult at the time, and we made it clear, though, that, and I had great support from Dr. Klink on this, that I didn't want to take over these units. We didn't, if the Navy and the Air Force wanted to have units on the campus, well, that was all right. But the COTC, there would be an overriding authority, and I would have that overriding authority as far as these units were concerned. But so long as they, for instance, they couldn't come on the campus and say, well, we will not have any parades, you see. Our students didn't like parades very much, especially if it rained. We'll just do theoretical work or something. I had the authority to say, no, that your program has to be such that it doesn't embarrass in any way the CODC, which had the mass of the students, you see. And this was done when the commanding officers were appointed. They were university professors too, you see, so that we had the very cordial relations. There was never any problem. When they started, we were worried about how it would be coordinated, and there was some concern about that. But after they were formed, and they picked good people from the university to head up these units, they were, as a matter of fact, both the people they picked had were COTC officers, you see. Head up the Air Force and the Navy were officers of mine, so there was no problem. But if they had sent somebody on the campus from outside, it might have been, you know, and we were just worried that there wasn't any conflict.
Did you continue all your duties as a head of the physics department at that time? You never slackened off on anything because of your other responsibilities?
No, I was head of the physics department and director of the extension department.
You must have been extremely busy then.
Yes.
Do you think that the officers' training that the men underwent on campus, do you think this equipped them well for service abroad?
Oh, the training they got here?
Yes.
Oh, I think it was just a start. I don't know, they certainly wouldn't be equipped to go into on active service. They'd have, but they would have some basic training, so they'd have to have further training for an officer. You couldn't go from the CODC into a unit in France, say, directly.
Where would an officer go once they left UBC and enlisted? Did they go to another Royal Academy or to a special training?
They'd go to a special officer training school.
What sort of feedback did you have? Did you get any of your recruits or officers who had trained in COTC writing you letters during the war?
Oh, yeah. I one fellow, he wrote to his mother. His mother sent me the letter. He said, you know, when I was at the COTC, oh, he said the conditions over here, very hardships are very great, the frightening, the shells and so forth. But he said, you know, I don't think, even overseas, I've ever been quite so frightened as I was with Colonel Schramm in the CODC. So I figured that the discipline worked pretty well. But we had, the CODC people distinguished themselves. But I think they would have distinguished themselves anyway because they were superior people. It wasn't the training they had. I guess the only VC from UBC was the chap that was in the naval, went in the naval service, but he'd been in the COTC. And then there was fellow who had a tremendous record, medals. Can't think of his name now, over from Vancouver on. He was one of these young sergeants in his first year in the COTC. But this was because they were a superior person. I don't think that the training, the discipline was the most valuable part of the training, because it's very difficult for a person to go from civilian life into an officer training school and immediately subjected to this intense military discipline. And if you start to fight it and resent it, well, then you're really in difficulty. So I think that indoctrination to discipline was a great help to people go on in their military service.
Camps were set up in Nanaimo. This is for summer training for
yes.
And also, there's a comment in the annual that this is much more rough than at UBC. I wonder if this is set up as kind of a transition. You're describing the rifle range in the basement of the arts building.
Well, Colonel Letson was a very fine rifle shot. He had been on the Bisley team many times, and he was one of the best shots in Canada. So naturally, he wanted to encourage us in the COTC. And so we built a rifle range under the, I guess one would call it the south end of the arts building, that wing. And it was a very fine rifle range, but unfortunately the target area was right under the Dean of Women's office. And some of the other professors were over in that wing, that was where the offices were, in that side of the building. They were very worried for some of the shots would get through, but we put the steel plate under there, so, and of course from the position in which the rifles were held, the bullet might have pierced the steel plate, but it wouldn't at a glancing angle. In any case, that was just one of the little problems.
And you had your parades and drills in Beattie Street Armory, is that correct?
Practically all in the Beattie Street Armory, because I don't think the Seaport Armories was built at that time. So that we used the Beattie Street Armory. And Colonel Letson had some connection down there too.
How was the response of the local military command in Vancouver and the militia? Did you have a cooperative relationship?
Yes, a very cooperative relationship with the militia here. This was in the very early days. Of course, the military headquarters over in Esquimalt, and the different the commanding officers over there were very helpful and cooperative all the way through.
Who provided the instructors for the officers' training?
Well, the instructor we had was Captain Gibson. He was quite a good instructor, but then he was followed by a fellow named Staff Sergeant Smith. And this fellow was just out of this world as far as an instructor is concerned. He had very little education, very little. But he had very high ideals, was hardworking. He used to have his office in this basement, and that wasn't a basement, it was underground of the arts building. We had a little arrangement there where the members of the Corps, in one of the instruction rooms we had, a little narrow instruction room, they used it for a lunchroom. Staff Sergeant Smith, sometimes he'd go out to that lunchroom and he said, "Look, you boys, I have no education, but I wouldn't dirty my mouth with some of the language going on out here. And you can't be members of this Corps if you're going to use language like that. Get out." But he was the one who kept them working and won the prizes for us in the competition. He was not only a good shot too, he supervised that, but he also on the Certificate A and Certificate B examination. He was a tremendous instructor. But then when the war broke out, he said, "I'm not going to stay in this funk hole during the war," so he headed east. Poor fellow never got farther than Saskatoon, I think. He became a major, I think they made, but they retained him there as instructor. He was just too good. There's no way. He was so anxious to get into the war. But then we were sent a number of instructors here by the military. But we didn't have any. See, immediately they made it compulsory to be a student at the university. You had to be in good standing in the officer training corps. And so that gave us about 1,800 students.
Yeah.
Oh. And some of these people weren't at all interested in military training. Different in the old days, when you only had 30 or 40 who were very enthusiastic and willing to face all this opposition in order to train and set a good example and do nothing to bring any discredit on the CODC. Here we have 1,800 students, you see, and no student officers speak of. The student officers we had enlisted and gone, you see. So, but by this time, the cadets were pretty active in the schools, and I had found that some of these cadet NCOs and so on were quite good. And they seemed to be mostly freshmen. And so that I enrolled these, gave these cadets stripes, and they took charge of a great deal of the instruction, but and they helped. We had some officers. But it was a very difficult undertaking. Then, of course, we had a large group of these people who said, we're not going to waive our pay. They had been feel the same, why should we waive our pay? Well, my attitude was that the boys who had been in there before waived their pay, and these people were being, they did it voluntary, they were taking training voluntary. These people had to take the training in order to stay in the university. But you can't force a man to waive his pay, you see, he has to sign. So what we did was that we only had an establishment for 1,200, so they called, that was the establishment. But we had to train everybody, we had to train 1,800, so I had to train 1,800 with whatever funds and staff was provided for 1,200. So when it came to pay, there was only 1,200 to get paid. So we lined them up, and we had two registers for them to sign. We say to the fellow, do you want to waive your pay or not, you see? Well, he doesn't want to waive his pay. All right, he goes in that line. If he's willing to waive his pay, he goes in this line. Well, only the people in this line got pay. The ones in the other line were supernumerary. There was no pay. They didn't have to waive anything, you see.
Did you get 1,200 out of 1,800 to waive their pay?
Oh, yes, we had no trouble. And later on, that was... And after we once established it, we never had any problem, real problem. I think these people thought this was quite a good stunt, that they refused to waive their pay, and they signed the pay sheet for which there was no pay. We never had any trouble after that.
Who paid? Was this the Department of National Defense?
Oh, yes.
And administered by the local headquarters?
Well, it was a standard arrangement for it, but then the money came to us, you see. When the pay was waived, we had this, and we built the army. Then we set up these trust funds. There are two trust funds at the university now. One for the Navy. Navy always wants to be a little different. And the other one for the CODC.
Well, you were an officer right from the beginning, 1928. You were a captain of one of the two companies. maybe you just describe what your duties were prior to becoming officer commanding.
Oh, well, you give some lectures, not very many. I couldn't compete with this Staff Sergeant Smith. He was too good. But on parade, I always have to go down to a parade at night when the parades are on. And then there was inspection, always inspection every year, and a great rehearsal for this inspection.
Did you give drill yourself?
Oh, yes. Well, I was quite good at that because I had been a sergeant in this large group at Toronto, you see, a couple hundred university students. They had no NCOs. I was one of the first NCOs, so I did a lot of training, handling parades. I was quite good at that, I think, and had a voice that could be heard in any case. But, you know, on the inspection, when we had the great mob of students in the CODC, and Senator Griesbach, he was Inspector General for Western Canada. His headquarters was in Edmonton. And he came down here, and he was inspecting everybody, all the military units and so on. And he was just raising hell with them. Well, he was supposed to be very tough. And so he's coming out to UBC, and everybody was nervous and so on. And my spies had told me what tricks he was up to, and so I thought, well, this is, we have to fight fire with fire. So one of the things he was asking these people to do, like you were on active service, an NCO would know all his people, all the history about them, and he was their leader. Well, at UBC, they might have one group of students one day and another group the next day, or it was so much changing around and units were large. There was no way they could get to know these people. So when he, before he came to inspection, we inspected at the west end of the auditorium building there where those huts are, or, I mean, the buildings are now for education or something. I don't know. But in any case, there was a plot of land there we used for an inspection. And after we'd gone through our, what we could do, march past as a regular routine for them, then he goes along the ranks, up and down the ranks, and he would stop. And he'd say to the NCO, what this man's name or what years he's been, so on. So I had all the students in the auditorium, and I explained how this was done. Now he said, when he comes along, and he says to the corporal, or lance corporal, or sergeant, whoever it may be, do you know the name of your people? You tell him, yes, sir. Well, what is this man? What's his name? Well, his name is Jones. John Jones. What faculty is he in? He's in agriculture. What year is he in? Second year. And I said, you just tell it just as if it's fact, you know. I said, never stop to consider whether anything, just give them a name, give them a year, just bang, 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 you see, and practice it. So these fellows went out, we had them practicing this. So then old Griesbeck came along, and he had, went through this very same thing, and then he'd say to the fellow, is that correct, you see? Well, I didn't put enough emphasis on the response. And some of these fellows would think, you know, and they'd be very shy and back. Yes, it's correct, you know. And so when he finished the inspection, he complimented all the NCOs. He did a terrific job. He thought they could have had a little more cooperation from the men in the ranks.
This is, of course, during the war when it was a very large unit. I mean, like in the 1930s before the war, probably very compact.
Before the war, we only had 30 or 40 altogether. Some of them would change.
In one company. 30 or 41 companies.
Yes, that's right.
And, there are two
and some of them would change their minds and they wouldn't be very active and examinations come along. We used to have a little difficulty getting them out.
Yeah.
The interest flagged a bit from at the very beginning in 1928-29, there was tremendous enthusiasm. And then it sort of tapered off until the war came along, you know.
How did the Depression affect the Corps? Military spending generally was really cut back.
Yes.
Especially in 1932.
Yes, there wasn't very much spending as far as the Corps is concerned, but I don't recall that it affected us very much. We had just such a small unit, and the amount of money involved was very small.
Did the local militia give you a lot of encouragement as far as, were they really interested in the officers you were turning out there?
No, they weren't, no, not particularly interested. As a matter of fact, they would like to have some of these fellows enlist in their units and take their training downtown rather than COBC. And there were a few students who did that, but they couldn't get the same officer qualification. But if they grew up as a Seaforth cadet, they might want to stay with the Seaforth or something. I think there were a few of these. Generally speaking, they cooperated, but they weren't 100% enthusiastic about the CBC. I think they, because we were being attacked at the university, they felt a loyalty to support us, you know, because of we were actually part of the military organization.
Yeah. How about, what sort of feedback did you get, I'm still speaking of, say, before the war, as far as the quality of officers who were commissioned in the ranks? Do you recall?
I don't recall very much, but most of these fellows that we had were extremely good because they were enthusiastic and they were selected 30 or 40 people from a student body, male student body. The student body is small, but a high percentage of males in the university anyway. So they were quite a select group. And the ones who actually qualified, everybody didn't qualify, didn't stay with it. They were superior people. Why they, I don't know how many air vice marshals when the war broke out, like John Plant and Smith and Kennedy and a number of the CODC people ended up as air vice marshals.
1934-35, I think, was the peak of the anti-war movement on campus, if you're judging from articles in the UBC and the meetings, the commotion going on. Do you have any memory of that?
They wanted, oh, yes.
They voted to abolish the CRTC, for example.
Yes, we wouldn't... we didn't let the people bring their uniforms. They couldn't come on the campus in uniform. Even in the militia units, some of the militia units had to build quarters. New Westminster, for instance, I know, built quarters in the armory where people could come and change and then go back in civilian life. It wasn't safe to walk home with a uniform on.
Was this the case on campus, too, that it was...
I wouldn't say that it wasn't safe on the campus, but... we didn't want to antagonize these people by appearing on the campus in uniform, so that generally speaking, we said, well, you go to the, we didn't have, they could put the uniform on and go to the Beatty Street Drill Hall, but we didn't do anything on the campus in uniform. Even Staff Sergeant Smith, as a rule, would always be in civilian clothes on the campus in the early days.
Did you have any personal encounters at that time with...
No.
People who are...
I know personal experience with this at all.
How did you feel about it? How did it affect? Did it affect the morale of the Corps?
No, it's just sort of knitted together a minority group, you might say. If you want to maintain high morale in a minority group, I guess attack them by a majority, you know.
Do you think the morale was quite good?
Yes, excellent. They would do anything they were asked to do pretty well, these COTC people. But I myself, I used to, having been in the ranks, I appreciated how students felt about officers. We had some pretty poor officers in my day. And so that the one thing that I always tried to do was not to ask the men to do anything I wasn't prepared to do myself. Although I had an officer's uniform, I used to go over with them at Christmas to the Work Point Barracks, and the floors were wooden floors that had been well oiled, deep down the dust and so forth. But I used to lie on the floor with the men, whatever they were going through, we'd go through the same thing. Not too much, just standing by. Supervising, you know.
What was it like at Work Point, Squire Mall, compared to the UBC campus?
I don't know. I enjoyed it.
Was it more rugged?
Because it was sort of nostalgic. They burned coal in the little stoves in the huts, and you smell this coal smoke. Well, it always reminds me of the First World War. It smelled the same. sort of nostalgic, I guess.
Was your training sort of still First World War premises, trench warfare, massive use of infantry? Is that sort of the basis for your...
No, we were always trained to fight in the open. We were always, in the Certificate A examination, I don't think trench warfare was ever mentioned in the before World War I in the training. And then when we were training the artillery for World War I, we never had any instructions, as far as I know, building a gun pit. We always had these horses, tremendously exciting, like going to a fire, galloping like, as fast as the horses could go, and then halt, unhitch the horses, and quick release, halt action front just to see how quickly you get firing. And these were the competitions, usually. Which battery would be the first one to be in action, you know? Well, of course, we only did that only once in 3 years in the World War. Actually, in the war, I was involved in open movement of the guns and halt and action front once only. But the rest of the time, we sneak up after 11 o'clock at night by some back road and try to get the guns into a gun pit that had been built beforehand, but this was no instruction of that. But in the, even the infantry instruction before World War II, the manuals hadn't been rewritten very much in the meantime, and so that there wasn't, I can't recall any instruction. I think I must have some of the old manuals about trench warfare. Even for World War II, we were still maneuvering out in the open.
What do you remember of the balls at the Jericho Country Club? I think these fall of your annual inspection.
Yes.
What were they like?
Oh, these are tremendous. We enjoyed them. Of course, they didn't cost anything for the boys. They were very well behaved. And we would invite some of the officers from the regiments, and they would come in their scarlet and blue uniforms and so on. So it was always written up as a colorful event. I think the boys enjoyed it. I always enjoyed it.
I think the 1937 issue of the annual, the Totem, said one of the balls of that year is carried on the, quote, noblest of British tradition.
Right.
How would you interpret that?
Oh, I don't know what exactly what that meant, but they were very rather formal affairs, and people were in uniform, and they exchanged dances with other people. And
I wasn't sure how to take that. I thought it was
I don't know exactly
an understatement of some kind, maybe.
I don't know exactly what it means myself.
I'm not sure what British traditions they're referring to.
For balls.
If they're referring to hit the real wild, you know.
Well, there would be no problem whatsoever with fellows drinking too much or anything of that sort. Never. And maybe that's what they meant, that they were formal, very well behaved, so forth. Nothing rowdy about it.
How would you compare, say, Lieutenant Colonel Letson's command with Lieutenant Colonel Logan's, Dr. Logan?
Well, I rather like Colonel Letson's way of doing things. It's more my way of doing things. I'll give you an example. When you're in the military, you expect your commander, whoever he is, if he's a corporal, you expect to be told what to do, and you do it. If he's a lieutenant or a captain, major, whatever it is. So I remember, I'll just give you this as an example without any criticism of Colonel Logan. But we're having an inspection down at Beatty Street Armory. And I said to Colonel Logan, "Now what do you want me to do tonight?" You say, "What's my..." Because the colonel falls out and stands beside the commanding officer. There's all this. I said, "Now just what do you want me to do?" And he said, "What would you like to do, Gordon?" You know. Well, I felt so let down because in a military organization, you don't expect that, you see. And that's the way he ran it. He was very popular and people liked him and everything that he did. But from a military point of view, he wasn't as decisive. Now, Colonel Letson would say beforehand, "Now you'll do so-and-so, and this will be your job, and so-and-so." You know, I mean, everything was laid out very concise and snappy orders and so on. So that it was more of the traditional military handling. From that point of view, he was good.
You were...
He had a great number of connections, too, with the senior military people, both in Ottawa and Victoria and so forth, so that it may have been a little easier to make arrangements for camps and things.
You obtained a certificate in 1936 from the military staff, a military staff course. This is exactly all.
Yes, I went, in those days, qualify as a major. You had to have what they called equitation. So I went to riding school up here at the police barracks up on 33rd. And I enjoyed that. Went up about 2 weeks ago up there every morning and riding, because I've been in the field artillery and had ridden horses for 3 years in World War I, so, but I didn't have any certificate, you see. So I liked it so much that I took it 2 years in succession, even although I passed it, I went back and took it again. A nice free riding and good horses. Well, then I went down and took this military staff course at Sarcee, and that was a very good course too.
What did that qualify you for?
Well, I guess it qualified me. I guess that was part of the qualification for a major or a field officer, I guess. When you once get a qualification for a major, there's very little further qualification needs for colonel, for lieutenant colonel. So I think major and lieutenant colonel, known as field officers, I think. And I took that in order to qualify for field officer.
Did you know that you were going to be appointed commanding officer?
No, I didn't know the war was going to break out, but...
this was 1937.
Sure.
This was 1937 when you were...
Yeah. Well, but things were getting pretty disturbed in international situations. Very suddenly, Colonel Letson, I guess he was appointed officer commanding this... No, he wasn't. I guess he was officer commanding the Duke of Connaught's rifles, I guess. The Beattie Street people that had the Beattie Street Army, the DCORs, I think they called them. I think he became colonel down there. And so he had to leave the COPC. But this came on very suddenly.
He was under instruction from his superior then to take over the new post, the position.
Well, I think he was offered it and he took it, you know.
Did you want at the time to become commanding officer?
Well, I didn't have much time to think about it. I wasn't consulted. I was just, he said, well, I'm leaving and you'll have to take over. And I don't know. I couldn't say whether I wanted it or not. I wasn't really... a keen student of military affairs. I didn't spend a lot of time on it. Now, Colonel Letson did a great deal of reading and studying on this, but I don't think Colonel Logan did either. He did the job here. I had no ambition to go on up to be any higher rank than just my association. My interests were entirely with the university and CODC. I had no ambition to go any farther. Colonel Letson did, and he went on and became a general in World War I.
What was your attitude as a commanding officer? How did you see, for example, what do you think was the proper relationship between a commanding officer and its subordinates and men?
Well, in World War I, I felt that I was able to come back as a healthy individual in World War I, because the colonel that we had was a very strong disciplinarian. The training officer we had in the COPC, the training officer we had when I first enlisted in the artillery in World War I was a very strong disciplinarian. And then I was fortunate to get posted to a unit in France with a very strong disciplinarian. And for instance, our battery wouldn't be shelled. But other batteries in the same brigade, there'd be four batteries in a brigade, we'd see them getting a daylight knocked out of them by shelling. And we wouldn't be shelled. Why? Because we had good discipline. And when the colonel said nobody puts his head out or nobody steps out in daylight and so on, nobody did. And these other people would be fooling around, maybe go up behind them, play catch or something, you know, and give away their position. Well, so, and I told the students when I took over and a war broke out, just after the war broke out, I said, you know, we don't have any equipment, we don't know what the fighting's going to be like, there's very little training that I can give you that's useful other than good discipline. So I said, we're going to have very strict discipline. And we did. And we had a good way of enforcing it, too, because we used to say, if a fellow didn't do as he was told, we'd turn him out of the CODC, and then he'd be called up right away. I had quite a nice working arrangement with Judge Manson, who he lived around the corner here. He was in charge of the call-up. I don't know what the official title was. But by this time, Dean Finneson was the Dean of Engineering. And unlike Dean Brock, who'd been Dean of Engineering and very enthusiastic about military, Dean Finneson had no use for the military at all, and he felt that all engineering students should be exempt from engineering, that their engineering training was more useful than their military training, and he told the students this. And he didn't help us at all, I would say. Well, he had one student who was a top student, one of his very best students in civil engineering, and this fellow refused to take training. And so we struck him off strength. He wouldn't turn out